I think we are ready to kick things over. Today's speaker is Bob Johnson from Argonne National Lab. Before I turn it over to Bob, just last reminder to the phone participants to put your phones on mute by pressing *6. Do not put us on hold. Bob, if you're ready, feel free.
I guess, Jean, were we going to cover questions from last time, or were there outstanding questions that we needed to revisit before we jump into this presentation?
Exactly. If everyone could move on to number 3, which is the remaining questions from session 5 on quality control. Steve, you were on the line. I think we had one last question that came in last time that we weren't able to address. If you're there. Okay, it seems we may have lost Stephen Diamond from the Technology Innovation Program. Hopefully he'll dial back in. But are you there? Yeah, no problem.
The only remaining question was with regards to the slide where I was talking about duplicates and using standard deviation as a proxy to relative percent difference.
Mm-hmm.
And the question was, when would we recommend using that? And I think there's to that slide and through some of the other discussions that we had on that it was fairly obvious that there's some shortcomings with using relative percent difference because it's so dependent on concentration. So the recommendation that we would make is that standard deviation would be used in place of a relative percent difference. In that particular slide and in that spreadsheet, we've actually included both, just as a comparison. But I think, and if Bob wants to add anything to it, I think, Bob in particular said that he would advocate for using the standard deviation with the Z distribution, as a way to assess the duplicate precision.
No, I would agree with that, Steve.
Okay, so if you guys don't have any further follow-up, that would be the last remaining question we had from session 5, and I think we can begin today's session, which is session number 6. So I'll direct everyone to move forward to slide number 4, and this is module 6.1 on dynamic work strategies, part 1.
All right, this is actually the first of a two-part series on dynamic work strategies. The second follow-up will be on Monday. We're going to be talking about different ways that one can use an XRF to improve characterization work that's being done in the field. I'm going to be covering a lot of ground in the next 2 days, so we're going to be presenting some concepts and some approaches and spending a little time on each, but not going into a lot of detail. So the basic aim here is not so that when we're done with this that everybody's an expert in the various things that we're presenting, but rather to tweak your interest. And if you see something that you think might have application to what you're doing, feel free to ask one of the instructors offline or after the series is done about how that might actually be implemented. We'd be happy to follow up. So, like I said, I'm going to be going through some of these concepts fairly fast. I apologize for that. I just want to make sure that we cover all the ground that there is to cover. And if you have questions, we'd be happy to field those either as part of this or offline. So if we could go and move on to slide number 5. In the next 2 modules, I'm actually going to be covering 4 different topics. Today we're going to focus on the first 3, planning systematically, improving representativeness, increasing information, and then on Monday we're really going to hit addressing the unknown. And Mondays is really focused on dynamic work strategies per se. Although we will touch on some dynamic work strategies today. And just as an aside, when I talk about dynamic work strategies, the thing that I'm talking about is going to the field not with a prefixed plan of that contains the number of sampling locations and exactly where they are and exactly what you're going to do with the XRF for each sample, but rather a decision logic that's going to help guide you in making those decisions as your work progresses. One of the key benefits of an XRF is that it, in fact, provides information in real time. In a matter of seconds, you have a sense for what your sample might contain, for the contaminants of concern that you're interested in. And what we want to be able to do is to leverage that information as we're generating it to keep your sampling program as focused and as efficient as possible so that you get to your end goal as quickly as possible using an XRF. And there are some things that you can do with an XRF in the field that you could never even imagine doing if you were relied on simply off-site laboratory analysis, say ICP. So use of something like an XRF just opens a lot of possibilities for ways to do things differently in the field that wouldn't be options otherwise. So let's jump right in here with planning systematically. So if we could go on to slide number 6. Usually when we give these courses in a classroom setting, the first question we ask the audience is how many people don't plan systematically when they're doing their field work. And, of course, nobody raises their hand because everybody would like to believe that systematic planning is a fundamental part of the characterization work that they do. From our perspective, we're going to spend a little bit of time with systematic planning because there's some things here from a triad perspective that we'd like to emphasize, and there's also some dimensions to it that are particularly pertinent to designing a program around a real-time technique such as the XRF that we want to make sure that we hit. So what is systematic planning? Well, systematic planning is that process whereby you define the decisions that you want to make. Out of those fall your decision units that Dina talked a bit about, and out of that are sample support requirements. You probably have heard of data quality objectives and that planning process. That's an example of a systematic planning process. And so we're not going to be in front of you here advocating a particular kind of systematic planning process that you should follow, but instead what we're going to do is emphasize some key dimensions or components that we'd expect to see in a systematic planning process that would support the deployment of something like an XRF. So one of the things we hope that comes out of our systematic planning process is an identification of the sources of decision uncertainty. What are the things that prevent you right now without going to the field from making the decisions you need to make to go forward with cleaning up your site? All right. So part of the systematic planning process is to figure out what those things are and then to come up with strategies for managing that decision uncertainty. And one of those strategies might be collecting data using something like an XRF. As part of this whole process, our presupposition is that you have clearly defined cleanup standards. And what do we mean by clearly defined cleanup standards? Well, we mean things that not only include an action level, say 400 ppm for lead, but also include a specification of the area or volume of soil over which that action level has to hold on average. So, for example, 400 ppm over the backyard of a residence down to a depth of 6 inches. That would be a complete cleanup definition. Unfortunately, it's fairly common to run into projects or specific sites where a cleanup criteria is expressed as a concentration goal, but there's no associated area associated with that goal. So it might simply be cleanup lead to 400 ppm, full stop. Dina hit on this on earlier modules, but I'm just going to revisit it for just a moment because it's so important. Designing a technically defensible sampling program with that kind of cleanup goal specification is impossible to do. All right, now I'll just be blunt about it. If somebody were to approach me and say, design a sampling program for this site that verifies that I don't have any problems over 400 ppm for lead, I'd have to turn around and say, I'm sorry, I can't do that for you. Fact is that I always need, if I'm going to design a sampling program, I always need some kind of spatial definition that will go along with that action level, because that then allows me to design a program that will demonstrate that, in fact, we've attained the goal that we want. Last point on this slide is that in the systematic planning process, something called a conceptual site model is really foundational. And I'm going to touch on a conceptual site model a bit more in the next series of slides, but this really is something that, at least from a triad perspective, we feel is the nugget of the systematic planning process, because it's a conceptual site model that falls out of the systematic planning process that, in fact, then becomes the foundation for everything else that gets done. Are there any questions about this slide? If not, then let's go on to slide number 7. So, conceptual site model. It is the key to successful projects. And when I talk about a conceptual site model, I want to be clear. I don't want you to confuse that term with, say, a patent transport model or a risk exposure scenario model. Although those might be parts or components of a conceptual site model, they in and of themselves are not a conceptual site model. Basically, a conceptual site model pulls together everything that we know about the nature, extent, fate of contamination, and exposure to that contamination at a site. That's pertinent to the decisions that we have to make. And that's the purpose of a CSM. Excuse me. It's basically your mental picture of all the pertinent site characteristics that need to be taken into account. And what we'd like to do is take that mental picture and translate it into text, to graphics, to models, whatever, to make sure that it gets captured and conveys our understanding of the site. And in the process of doing that, also identifies those points in that conceptual site model where we're not so sure about the reality of the site, where we may need some additional information or some additional data to really clarify things before we can go forward and make the decision we need to make. Next slide, please. Slide number 8. You've probably seen graphics like this, and they're fairly common. This is a pictorial representation of a subsurface groundwater plume, basically. It conveys a sense for where the contamination is at this particular site and where it might be going and what the levels are. The question is how well does a graphic like this really match reality? Now, a couple of things that you might note about this particular graphic. First of all, we really don't have a sense for the number of data points that are contributing to the isoplex that this graphic portrays. There may be 4, there may be 5, there may be 10, there may be only 2 or 3. We really don't know. The other thing, if you look at this at all, you'd say, well, golly, do we really know exactly where all those isoplex are to that degree of precision? And is it really true that once we've crossed the 40 isoplex, from there going to the 50, everything is, if we had taken a sample there, everything would be between 40 and 50. Wouldn't see any variation in what we get. Point here is that oftentimes when we use graphics like this to convey our image of the site, those graphics are simplifications of what reality is. And in the course of making those simplifications, we lose one of the key things that we really need to stay focused on, and that is, what's the level of certainty with this mental image? Where are the data gaps? Where are the things where we aren't so sure about exactly where that boundary is or what we'd find if we actually poked a hole there and took a sample? Let's go on to the next slide, slide number 9. Here's an alternative display of reality. This is a graphic that's based on data collected with a MIP, a membrane interface probe, where we have very detailed vertical information from core to core, although there may be a fair amount of spatial separation between individual cores. And as you can see from this particular picture where we've interpolated MIP results between cores, the reality is typically a lot messier than that previous graphic might suggest. And even this particular graphic is probably a simplification of what life is like. Because while we may know fairly precisely what's going on down in each core, what's going on between cores is strictly a matter of interpolation. And in this particular case, we have a piece of software that did that interpolation for us. How believable are those blobs that connect the cores? Well, I don't know. It's probably worth something, spending some time thinking about and talking about. But clearly what we have here with a denser data set is something much more complicated than what we had in the previous graphic. And I would maintain that if we had more data, the end result would not be a simplification, but something that's even more complicated still. Any questions about this? Let's go on to the next slide then, slide number 10. So CSMs, conceptual site models, are critical from a systematic planning process. And whether they're openly articulated or not, that CSM is really the basis of all site decisions. One of the realities that I commonly run into when I'm associated with sites is when there's disagreements between the site problem holder and, say, a regulator, and you get down to the nub of the issue, it often boils down to the fact that they hold different CSMs. That the site owner may think this particular area, very little chance of contamination, why bother? The regulator, on the other hand, may say, well, wait a minute, I don't think that's quite the reality of the situation. Going through this process of constructing a CSM and articulating it, getting it down on paper, whether it's in text or graphically, helps to flush out and bring into concurrence people's ideas and differences of opinion about what the true status of the site is. And really, it's those differences of opinions that might subsequently drive the need for data collection in any particular portion of the site. The other thing about a CSM is that it's a living thing. It's a living being. As you collect more data, you're going to be revisiting your CSM and updating your mental image and your verbal image of the site. and hopefully refining it and improving it until it gets to the point where you're comfortable enough with it that you then can confidently make the decisions that you need to make. It's particularly important for an XRF because that's one of the strengths of an XRF is it's producing data in real time. And if our real-time data collection is coupled with our CSM, we should be revisiting that CSM and updating it as that new data becomes available to us from our XRF. So this CSM is really a working hypothesis about what the site's physical reality is. If we don't have a CSM, then it's like working blindfolded, right? We really don't have a basis for the decisions that, or for the design of a data collection effort that we might want to design. Any questions about this? If not, let's go on to slide number 11. So, here's one of the most important functions of a CSM, and that is to articulate the uncertainty associated with our understanding of our site. Alright, so a complete CSM will not only capture what we know, it'll identify what we don't know. And that identification of what we don't know then becomes the foundation of data collection design. And we're specifically collecting data then to fill in those CSM gaps, to address those CSM uncertainties. As a matter of fact, we can also collect data to test our CSM assumptions, i.e., we don't think there's contamination over here, but we're not 100% sure, so we're going to collect some data to verify that that assumption is correct. All right? So again, that CSM, in the manner that it articulates uncertainty, becomes the foundation of our data collection program, because our data collection program is going to target that uncertainty that we've identified and addressed that's been associated with our CSM. And the last bullet in this slide emphasizes what I've already said. It's a living thing. As new data become available, we're going to be revisiting that CSM again and again and updating it until we're content and can make our decision. Okay, next slide, please. Slide number 12. So what might a CSM look like? Well, up in the upper left-hand corner of the slide, you'll see text with a question mark. And really, the question mark shouldn't be there because a CSM will always include textual information about what our understanding of the site is. But beyond text, a CSM could include lots of different components. It could include computer models. It could include a receptor flow chart. There could be a 2D or a 3D cross-section fence diagram, a 3D physical model. Could be a variety of things that get incorporated into a CSM that are used to convey our understanding of the site and identify those places where our understanding perhaps is lacking. Whatever those things are, one of their purposes is to help us organize our thinking and communicate that thinking, that CSM, to other people that need to understand it. Next slide, please. Slide 13. So here's some other possibilities. Upper left hand, we have a solid model. We have some cross sections here. We have a schematic that shows how we might think geochemistry is working within a groundwater plume. Then these are all possibilities of ways a CSM might be presented or specific information in the CSM might be presented. Next slide, please. Slide 14. All right. So here's kind of where the rubber hits the road, though, with the XRF. So for the CSM and XRF, there are a couple of CSM elements that really are critical when you're thinking about designing a sampling program that involves an XRF. And I'm just going to walk through each of these. The first three, decisions driving the data collection, spatial definition, standards of concern, are kind of generic. They're not specific to an XRF. They're important for whatever kind of measurement technology or analytical technique you're talking about using. Decisions driving the data collection, you know, are we in an SI phase where we're just trying to identify what those contaminants might be? Are we in an RI phase where we need to collect data to estimate an exposure point concentration that's going to feed a risk assessment? Are we in a feasibility study phase where we really need to know what that contamination footprint is to support a remedial design? Are we actually in a remediation where we might be using an XRF to help drive an excavation as it's going forward? Or are we post-excavation? We're collecting data to verify that, in fact, all the criteria that are in place for our site have indeed been met. Each of those decisions might generate a different kind or a different flavor or variation on your sampling program, and it might involve a different strategy when it comes to actually deploying your XRF. So being as specific as you can about what those decisions are that need to be made is incredibly important for making sure that your XRF data collection program is really what you need. The second one I've talked about already a little bit, but again, I'm just going to hammer it because it's so important. That is, what are the spatial definitions of those decisions or action levels that that you're trying to address through your data collection program. Are you applying these action levels to a yard? Is it to an exposure unit? Are you looking for hot spots, you know, contamination that's elevated but on a much smaller scale than maybe somebody's backyard or an exposure unit? The third one is kind of self-evident. What are the contaminants of concern that you need to be addressing, and what are their associated action levels? And just to kind of tie those two together, I think we talked a little bit about it in previous modules, but if I can't remember, perhaps we didn't. Action levels oftentimes can take one of two forms. They may be area average kinds of action levels, where you want to attain some kind of standard over a fairly large area. But then you could also imagine having a more of a hotspot criteria, where you'd say, well, even if over an acre we've attained 20 ppm arsenic, still we want to be sure that there isn't anything the size of somebody's yard or a quarter acre or something smaller where we don't have arsenic at much more elevated levels that we ought to be catching. So you could imagine sites having both more of a general average kind of, large area average kind of action level that you might want to pursue, but you could also imagine at the same time also having hotspot criteria that might be applied that you'd want to address as well. The fourth one now becomes important from an XRF perspective, and that is matrix characteristics in co-contaminants that might affect the XRF. Why would you be concerned about this? Well, for a number of reasons. First of all, because your XRF is going to have varying degrees of effectiveness for different types of metals. So depending on the suite of contaminants that are there, your XRF might be very good for some, semi-good for others, and useless for still others. So we need to understand what those co-contaminants might be and which of those the XRF might actually be good at getting. The second thing that's going on there, though, of course, and Steve talked about, quite a bit about this, and that is interference effects. There may be elements present that are co-located that interfere with the XRF's ability to see any particular element. And it's important in our conceptual site model that we call those out and identify them, because that's going to have impacts on the way we design our XRF data collection program and the way we might interpret our XRF data. And finally, matrix characteristics. XRF performance is matrix specific. And if you have a wide variation in the types of matrices you're going to run into out there on your site, it may well have significant impact from matrix to matrix on the way your XRF behaves and on its performance. And so if you believe that you might be running into various types of soil types or significant variations in soil types, that'd be something to capture in your CSM and to think through what those implications might be for your XRF, and then to think through what you might do to address those potential problems and how you might try to cut them off at the pass, basically, through appropriate quality control. Spatial contamination patterns. Did your site experience more of a shotgun kind of distribution of contamination? Or do we have air deposition where it's limited really to the top couple inches of the soil? Or is there a burial that took place? Or are we looking at contaminated sediments where we're looking for a well-defined lens and we just don't know how deep that lens is, but we're looking for its presence and trying to determine where it is from a depth perspective? Those spatial contamination patterns and your understanding of those and your assumptions about those in your CSM will have an impact on the way you design your program and the way you deploy your XRF. So it's, again, important to capture that and to be explicit about that and to think through what the implications are for your XRF. Short-scale heterogeneity at action levels, and that's heterogeneity that's within a sample. Dina talked a bit about this. That's a significant issue for an XRF. I'm going to talk a lot more about that in some subsequent slides, but I'm just to put it here as a placeholder and to make you aware of it. And then the next one, the one that we more commonly think about, and that is the level of heterogeneity that one would expect to see around the action level when we're between samples. And also, if we take a sample here, how confident are we that it's representative of the area around it, or how unconfident are we that, in fact, there may be a lot of variability immediately surrounding that location that perhaps we're not aware of and not capturing with that sample. And then the last one, vertical layering of contaminants. This is an important one for an XRF, because one of the great ways you can use an XRF is to do in-situ scanning of exposed soils. And that could be the natural surface before excavation takes place, or if you're in an excavation process, it could be an exposed dig face. The way you'd interpret that data and the kind of value you put on it, that surface in-situ XRF reading, really depends on what your beliefs are about the vertical distribution of contaminants that are present. In other words, if you're looking for an air deposition event, you might have a lot of faith in taking in-situ XRF measurements of surface soils. If, on the other hand, you're looking for buried sediments that might have 6 inches of clean soil on top of them, an in-situ XRF measurement isn't going to do anything for you. So understanding your assumptions about how contamination might be vertically layered is important for the deployment of an XRF, particularly in an in-situ kind of mode. I covered a lot there on that slide. Are there any questions that I can answer or that people would like to talk a little bit further about? All right, then let's go on to slide number 15.
I have a question.
Sure, go ahead.
You mentioned that the different contaminants in a matrix can impact the actual readings of the XRF.
Yes.
Do you have any specifics about, for instance, if we have lead and arsenic or other metal?
Well, lead and arsenic, of course, are the classic example that Steve talked a lot about, I think, in the last module or two, where if you know you have, if arsenic is your primary concern, but you know you have, for example, somebody brought up the issue of industrial generalized urban lead contamination levels on the order of 200 or 300 ppm, that's going to have an effect on your arsenic data, and you better be aware of that and be thinking about that before you attempt to use an XRF in that setting. But there are other cases where you can have similar kinds of interference effects. Again, Steve had put up a nice slide the last presentation that identified various types of interferences what one might expect, or one needs to be aware of for specific elements. So that would be something to take a look at and to think about. I'm not sure whether that answers your question or not, but, you know, it's something of fair significance for an XRF, and it's just something that you need to be thinking about and paying attention to.
So to summarize, it depends on the elements that are present and also, more specifically, on the actual concentrations that these elements are present.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And the primary concern is not elements being present at background conditions. That's not the issue. The issue is when you have something that you have an interest in measuring, and then you have something else that may be tracking it,
right,
that may be elevated for other reasons, elevated at levels where it starts to introduce interference effects and affect your ability to accurately quantify the thing that you really have an interest in. So this is not an issue if you're dealing in background soils, but if we're just dealing with background soils, you would be doing XRF work at a site anyway, right? We're getting in sites because we expect to find things there that shouldn't be there. So that's why it's an issue.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, I would just add to that is if you go back and look at some of the slides from the previous sessions, particularly on the QC module and the DMA module, that you may be able to get some indication that those interferences are happening by looking at things like how are the average error that you see, are your detection limits going up, those sorts of things. If your errors are increasing, that the instrument's reporting and your detection limits are increasing unexpectedly, those are start to be some indications that you may have some spectral interferences going on. Then you can delve into it a little bit more by looking at the spectra and some of the other things that I talked about in the QC modules.
Now, something else we haven't really discussed in any of these modules, but I'm just going to bring it up here. And I don't know whether there's folks from Niton or Innovex on the line today, but my experience with both companies is that they are typically very helpful and very willing to look at site-specific conditions with you, if you have an interest in using their technology, to figure out whether there's something that you ought to be concerned about and take into account before you actually deploy your XRF. So when you're thinking about some of these things that are very XRF-specific, like potential interference effects or matrix effects, there is no harm at all in contacting the vendor you expect to work with and just talking to them about what it is you're going to be looking at and what the potential implications might be. And I suspect you're going to find them very willing and helpful and informative in answering those questions for you. Any other questions? Let's move on to slide number 15. All right, so enough of systematic planning. I'm sure everybody on the phone is an expert at systematic planning anyway, so I was preaching to the choir. Let's move on to the next main topic for today, and that is what can be done to improve representativeness when you're talking about collecting data with an XRF. And I've got a number of bullets here. I'm starting at the top, sample support, a concept that Dina talked quite a bit about. And in particular, matching sample support with decision needs. Just to revisit the definition of sample support so we're all on the same page. When I talk about sample support, it's kind of an awkward term, but what I'm referring to is that those physical characteristics, the dimensions, the depth, the mass of your soil sample that you're collecting and then analyzing, that's called the sample support. And actually, within the environmental arena, slightly different definition, slightly different connotation than if you're talking about sample support from a statistical perspective. So I doubt whether we have any statisticians on the phone today. But just to draw that distinction, it's a slightly different concept for environmental work than what you might, how you might see it used in the statistical world. But related to that is the field of view of an XRF, both for in situ analyses and also for bag samples and cup analyses. Again, Dina talked quite a bit about the field of view of an XRF. I just want to underscore it here, just so everybody is keeping it front and center in their minds. And the business end of an XRF is really only about the size of a postage stamp. And when it takes a measurement, it is only seeing the top couple millimeters of soil that sit right below that detector. It isn't seeing anything else. So whether you take a measurement on top of a tabletop or on top of a thimbleful of soil, the amount of soil it's actually seeing is no different, right? It's a very, very small amount of soil. That window that it sees is sometimes referred to as its field of view. And again, you just have to bear in mind that the field of view of an XRF detector is only about the size of a postage stamp. And that has implications when you're thinking about sample support and matching the data you're getting from an XRF, say, to some decision support definition. In other words, what's the definition of the decision unit over which you're trying to make a decision? We talked quite a bit about that, Dina and I both did, over the last couple of modules, so I'm not going to spend any more time on sample support. I'm going to skip to the next one now and talk about a little bit about controlling within sample heterogeneity. Again, Dina spent a lot of time on this. If you have any questions at all about what appropriate methodologies might be for sample prep, there's a good EPA publication, EPA 600R-03027, that you can refer to. If you don't know where it is, you can do a Google search on that title and it'll pop up. But it contains a lot of good information about ways to prep samples so that at the end of the day, you're confident that your sample is well homogenized, and when you subsample it, say for an XRF cup analysis, that in fact that subsample will reflect accurately the average concentration in the original sample mass itself. So I'm not going to spend much time with that. Dina hit that really hard. But I'm going to spend a little bit of time about the next sub-bullet there, and that is using an XRF to be more quantitative about exactly how good our sample prep is. I have another slide or two to talk about that. And XRF really presents some unique possibilities in that regard that we really don't have in almost any other analytical technique. And I'll spend a little bit more time talking about that. The third bullet is where I'm going to spend the bulk of my time today, and that is this issue of controlling short-scale heterogeneity. In other words, again, harkening back to Dina's slide, when you have situations where if you pull a sample here and analyze it and then move over a foot and take another sample, you're getting completely different results. How do you deal with that in the real world? And what kinds of strategies can you put into place to try to minimize those effects? So that, in fact, when you say, for example, for a residential yard, we think the concentration of lead in that yard is X, that you're very confident that, in fact, is X and isn't Y, and that sample heterogeneity or that short-scale heterogeneity isn't biting you. I'm going to talk a significant amount about that, and the things I'm going to talk about are multi-increment sampling and aggregating XRF measurements, both in situ and in a bag sample kind of setting. Any questions about that? That kind of lays out the direction of where I'm headed here for most of the rest of this talk. So let's go on to slide number 16. So again, XRF really is, if not unique, one of very few analytical techniques that allow you to really take a hard look at how effective your sample preparation process is at removing heterogeneities that are present within your samples. And again, I'm not sure how convinced you were by Dina's presentation, but if you weren't, I'm not sure what I can do to convince you, but hopefully you were convinced that heterogeneity within soil samples is a big deal, and it has a significant impact potentially on the quality of your analytical results, whether it be an XRF, cup analysis, whether it be a PCB analysis, whether it be an ICT analysis, anything that requires subsampling the original sample and then analyzing that subsample means you're going to be prone to sample heterogeneity effects if they're not dealt with. Okay, and what the XRF provides you in this scenario that's rather unique is that it is a non-destructive analytical technique. In other words, you can take the same piece of soil, same soil cup, and analyze it 100 times with an XRF, and you will not have done anything. You will not consume that sample. You won't have changed it in any other way. So you have the ability to reanalyze the same piece of material time and time again, and which then allows you to look at exactly how good your analytical performance is, strictly from an analytical error perspective. But the other thing about XRF measurements that are relatively unique is that they're very, very fast, can be very fast, on the orders of tens of seconds, which allows you to take multiple measurements over, say, a sample surface in a very short period of time and get some immediate sense for how much heterogeneity is present within that sample. So this is the scenario that I'm painting for you, and that is basically using your XRF as a way of getting at how good your sample prep methods are and determining whether they're doing what it is you intended them to do, which is to thoroughly homogenize your sample before subsampling it and having a lab or the XRF do that subsample analysis. So this works when the things you have an interest in are either detectable by an XRF, for example, lead, or whether the contaminant of concern that you're looking at may be co-located with something that's detectable by XRF. An example might be PCBs. Maybe your primary interest is PCBs, but there's some metal contamination mixed in those PCBs, and you're wondering how good your sample prep process is for making sure your sample's homogenized before you subsample it for doing your PCB analysis. Well, an XRF could potentially allow you to get at that question. So what do we do? Third bullet here, what we typically do is we'll perform 5 to 10 direct measurements with an XRF on a sample, and that sample could be bagged, or it could be exposed, say, in a flat kind of container. And you would do that pre-sample prep, and then you would do your sample prep, and then do it post-sample prep. And you would compare the standard deviation you see in your XRF set of results pre-prep with what you see post-prep. And that's going to give you a direct indication of how good your sample prep process was in removing the heterogeneity that was present in that sample. Now, I'm not suggesting that you do this for every sample, suggesting that this is something you might want to consider building into a QC program, just to make sure that when you've got your sample prep protocol in place, that in fact it's doing for you what you thought it might or what you're expecting it would do for you. And I think, unfortunately, you might be surprised at how good your sample prep process is at truly homogenizing samples, particularly when those samples have a fair amount of contamination in them. Typically what we would do is we would target samples that are expected to have contamination around our action level. That's really where we have an interest, is how is that heterogeneity behaving within the sample when we're at concentrations that would start to be of concern. So you'd review the resulting measurement variability, and then, you know, you'd make adjustments to your sample prep process if, in fact, you needed to. And this can be done as either part of a DMA before you actually do your field work, or it could be built into part of your ongoing QC program when you're actually in the field doing your work. Any questions about this slide? Really is a unique benefit that an XRF potentially provides you, but it's difficult to do in any other setting. If there's no other questions, then if there aren't any questions, then I'm going to move on to slide 17. So let me give you an example of what this can look like or how bad it can look. Here are 100 bag samples. This is real data. 100 samples that were bagged, and then they were analyzed multiple times across the bag surface for lead. The scatter plot that you see on the right-hand side, along the x-axis we have the average lead concentration that was observed in each bag, and then on our y-axis we have the standard deviation that was measured among the sets of results that were generated for each bag. So each point you see in that scatter plot actually represents the bag sample. And if you pick a point and go down, you'll see what the average lead concentration was in the bag for that bag sample based on multiple shots. If you go over to the left, you'll see how much variability there was in those sets of results, those sets of measurements that were taken for each bag. A couple of things I want you to notice here from this slide. First of all, that the variability that's present in bag samples in a sample you pull out of the ground is a direct function of how much contamination is there. When you're down at background levels, if you were to do this on a background soil sample, you would find very little variability within that sample, and that's because typically background concentrations of metals are fairly homogeneously distributed within the sample matrix. So it doesn't really matter whether you measure this part of the sample or that part of the sample, you end up getting the same result. As you get into samples where contamination has been introduced, however, the situation changes. And you, in fact, could start to see a significant amount of variability present in those samples, depending on which smaller portion of the sample you are actually looking at. Worst case scenario here, you can see it in this particular slide, there is one point way toward the top of the graph. It has an average concentration that's around 1,000 ppm, and it has a standard deviation associated with the multiple measurements done on that bag of around 400 ppm. What does that mean? Well, one way to think of that standard deviation is if you go two standard deviations on either side of the average, that pretty much bounds the range of values that you might expect to see if you were to subsample that original sample without doing any additional sample prep. In other words, in this one, plausibly, if we were to subsample this sample, we could get results ranging anywhere from 200 to 1800 ppm. That has nothing to do with analytical error. That simply has to do with the heterogeneity that's present in that sample. Our sample prep process, the whole reason for doing it, the homogenization process, is to try to drive that variability out to make it uniform. But to the degree to which we're effective, really depends on how well your homogenization process is, how good it is. All right, so this whole effect that this reality that the level of heterogeneity that's there is a function of our concentration. Remember that because it's an important thing that's going to come up later as we start to talk about multi-increment sampling. Are there any questions up to this point in time? I guess one other thing to just simply mention here, although we often don't have a luxury of knowing this up front, one of the other things you might want to take away from this slide is that if you have samples that are coming from background areas, you really don't need to spend much time on sample prep to get good data off those samples. On the other hand, if you're talking about samples that are highly contaminated, if you want consistent results from that sample, you have to spend a lot of time homogenizing that sample, otherwise you won't get it. Typically, when we approach a site, you know, we don't grade our sample homogenization or preparation efforts based on what we expect to find in that sample. There's one protocol that gets applied across the board to all the samples, irrespective of what we believe their contamination status to be. Point here is that one size fits all may not fit all your data, may not fit all the samples that you might be dealing with, and that there might be some specific samples where you might want to switch to something that's more effective, say a ball milling process that Dina described, to really try to address the heterogeneities that are there. All right, next slide, 18. So, I'm not a good joke teller like Dina and Steve are, so this is my one attempt at humor. This is a particular cartoon. And that is, you know, I'm the consultant they brought in to create some new statistical buzzwords. Multi-increment sampling, compositing, that's what the rest of this discussion is going to be about, primarily. And you probably have heard the terms multi-increment sampling. I'm sure everybody's heard the term compositing. Again, when we typically do this in a classroom, we'll ask, you know, compositing. For all of you that have a negative, for all of you that were compositing have a negative connotation, please raise your hand. And invariably, we'll get a fairly significant fraction of the audience who raise their hand and pull a face when we say compositing. And if you ask them why, the immediate response is pretty consistent, because compositing is equated with dilution, and dilution's a bad thing. Well, I'm going to talk about multi-increment sampling and compositing here in the rest of this presentation in a way that draws a distinction between the two terms. So when I use the term for the rest of the day, multi-increment sampling, I'm going to mean something different than when I use the term compositing. And you may never hear this distinction again outside this particular online XRF series, but hopefully in doing that, it'll cement a conceptual distinction in your mind that whatever you call it, you'll carry forward into field work that you do. So let's move to the next slide, slide number 19. If you go to guidance about multi-increment sampling and compositing, you're going to find that guidance very conflicting. And here are some examples. Way back in 1985, when the TSCA regulations first came out, if you take a careful look at some of the supporting documentation, you'll find references to being allowed to composite, what they called composite at the time, up to 10 adjacent samples before doing the PCB analysis. And at the time, it was in the recognition that TSCA sampling was fairly intensive, and so this was a way to keep analytical costs in control while still allowing a fairly dense sampling program to take place. If you live in the state of Maryland and you look at their 2001 guidance on groundwater and soils and the way things are implemented there, you'll find in their language that says that no more than 3 adjacent samples should ever be combined before an analysis is done. If you go to the latest revision of SW 846 method 8330B, this was October 2006, you're going to find a recommendation in there that you ought to be compositing 30 samples before you do your analysis. And finally, the latest one that I'm aware of, State of Alaska draft guidance dated 2007, this is specifically, I think, for petroleum hydrocarbon spills, that guidance talks about putting together 30 to 50 samples before actually doing an analysis. So it's not surprising if people feel a bit confused about multi-increment sampling or compositing, because certainly the guidance is confusing about what ought to be done. Next slide, please, which would be slide number 20. The distinction I'm going to make between multi-increment sampling and compositing is this. It's very simple. When I talk about compositing, I'm talking about pulling samples from discrete, separate locations from different decision units and combining them into one sample that is homogenized and then sent off for analysis. That's the way I'm going to talk about compositing. When I talk about multi-increment sampling, I'm going to refer to a situation where multiple samples from different discrete locations are taken within, all from within the same decision unit, say somebody's backyard, combined and sent for an analysis. I'm going to call that multi-increment sampling. All right? So I can't see people's faces. I don't know whether heads are nodding. I don't know whether I've lost you or kept you. But the distinction here is this. We're talking about physically doing the same thing, pulling samples from different locations, combining them before analysis, and then sending the combination off for analysis, whether it's XRF or ICP or PCBs or whatever it is. But multi-increment sampling, all those come from the same decision unit, contributing increments, whereas from compositing, all the contributing increments come from different decision units. Now, why the distinction? Let's go to the next slide, please. That's because they really perform two completely different functions. In the case of multi-increment sampling, the reason I'm doing it is I'm trying to control the effects of heterogeneity within that decision unit in a cost-effective way. In other words, I'm trying to come up with an average concentration that would apply to the decision unit. I want that average to be as good as possible, and I want to get it as cheaply as possible. And in that particular case, multi-increment sampling offers some real advantages. As opposed to compositing, as I'm using the term, where it's a strategy that tries to look for contamination that might be present in a way that keeps analytical costs as low as possible. So multi-increment sampling, I'm trying to come up with the best average that I can over a decision unit, as opposed to compositing. I'm trying to find a problem, and I'm trying to do it that might be out there, but I'm not sure whether it's out there or not, and I'm trying to do it in a very cost-effective way. I'm going to talk quite a bit more about multi-increment sampling in some subsequent slides. Compositing, and in particular something that we'll call adaptive compositing, we're going to punt to Monday. That's really a dynamic search strategy that we're going to talk a lot more in detail about on Monday. So, but this is the distinction I'm going to draw between these two terms. So for the rest of the balance of today, you'll hear me talking about multi-increment sampling, and you won't really hear me talking about, or at least I shouldn't use the term compositing again. And if I do, you can remind me that I shouldn't be. Any questions? All right, next slide, please. Slide 22. So when is multi-increment sampling or multi-increment averaging useful? Well, it's applicable when our goal is to improve the estimate of an average concentration over some specified area or volume of soil. Again, for example, over somebody's backyard. We want as good an estimate of the average concentration in that backyard as we can get. And in that particular case, multi-increment sampling is an effective way to do that. It's used to suppress short-scale heterogeneity. The idea is that we have multiple subsamples that contribute to one sample that's then analyzed. Those subsamples are typically systematically distributed over an area that's equivalent to or less than our decision unit size. Right? So we're not grabbing samples from other people's backyards, we're just focusing on this particular backyard that we have an interest in. And it's effective when the cost of analysis is significantly greater than the cost of acquiring your samples. This last bullet's really important from an XRF perspective, because I'm going to talk about that a little bit more, its XRF implications, because actually XRF provides a very cheap way of doing sample analyses. So we'll talk about what those implications are in just a moment. Any questions here about 22? All right, let's go on to 23. So this concept of multi-increment sampling applies to XRF in situ readings. It applies to bagged samples and doing multiple shots on a bag, and it also applies to doing cup measurements with an XRF. In the case of in-situ measurements, and here I'm specifically talking about you have a particular location and you're trying to get a sense for what the contamination is at that location, we might take multiple measurements with shorter acquisition times and then take the average of those measurements so that we get a better feeling for exactly what's there at that particular location. With an XRF bag, multi-increment sampling, really, that concept comes in two different ways. One is just the process of taking multiple shots around the bag surface is in some ways very similar to multi-increment sampling in that we're taking a bunch of shots and then doing the average to get a better sense of what the true average is within that bag. Also, though, you could think of multi-increment sampling being used in terms of the soils that contribute to that bag, that those increments coming into that bag came from different locations and then were combined in that bag before we actually did our XRF analysis. So it applies there as well. Then finally, with XRF cup measurements, you could think of multi-increment sampling, really in its true definition, that is, we have multiple increments of soil coming from different locations within our decision unit that are then getting homogenized together before we're pulling a cup out to measure with our XRF. Right, it's another way to think about it in the case of XRF cup measurements. Now, this last point on this slide is an important one. In general, multi-increment sampling isn't useful if your XRF can address all the contaminants of concern that are present, although some of the concepts might still apply. So the point here being, if, for example, your only contaminant of concern is lead, then you're going to use your XRF for going after lead, then it makes no sense to do multi-increment sampling. All right? Because your XRF measurements are so cheap and so fast, you might as well take an XRF measurement on every single increment that you're grabbing and be done with it. Okay? So where does it become, multi-increment sampling become important for an XRF? Well, oftentimes, our contaminants of concern are a bit more complicated than that. There may be more than one. One of which lends itself to an XRF, but another which does not. And because we have to go after the other one, multi-increment sampling then may become very important and then factors into the way we would deploy our XRF. As an example, let's say I had lead commingled with PCBs. I have no fast equivalent way of doing a PCB analysis on the fly like an XRF. So a multi-increment sample then could be very effective for my PCBs, and my XRF is piggybacking on top of that for the lead. And I'll get into some more of these details here in just a moment. Any questions so far? Okay, let's talk about slide 24. The question that people always ask is, okay, we bought into the concept that multi-increment sampling is good. How many increments do I need? Do I need 2? Do I need 5? Do I need 20? Do I need 50? Before I do my analysis, what's the appropriate number of increments to get? So I'm going to try to get an answer to that question in this particular slide. So again, let's just assume our goal is to estimate the average concentration over a decision unit, i.e. a yard, e.g. a yard. You can use something like visual sampling plan, And that software we've talked about before, it's free. You can download it from a website maintained by Pacific Northwest Laboratories. You can use something like VSP to determine or to estimate how many samples would be required if all were going to be analyzed. So that's one way of getting at the total number of samples that you might want to analyze. To do that calculation requires some knowledge of your expected contamination levels and the amount of variability that might be present in that yard. That's all information that you can potentially obtain using your XRF, and we'll talk more about that actually on Monday in the next module, but just as a placeholder, keep that in mind. But the bottom line is the last bullet there, and that is the number of increments that you would want to use should always be at least as great as the number that's identified by something like VSP. Right? So if you were to go through the sampling program design process with VSP and VSP spit out, you need 20 samples, you can look at that and say, okay, I should have at least 20 increments. And now I've got a couple of options. I could take those 20 increments and I could lump them into one sample and just analyze that one sample. Or I could take those 20 increments, I could break them up into groups of five, and from those groups of five increments each, make one multi-increment sample. That would give me four multi-increment samples that I would then analyze. So I'd be analyzing four samples at that point, still that were tied back to 20 original increments. So which is better, to take all those increments and combine them into one sample for analysis, or to take those increments, break them up into smaller groups, combine them into multiple samples, and analyze those multiple samples? If you think about the way residential lead characterization is typically done, it's very similar to the first approach, where you might have seen guidance, or you might have been involved in the kind of program where you take five increments, combine them into one sample, homogenize that sample, and send it off for ICP analysis for lead. And then you say, well, that's my estimate of lead concentration in that yard. Okay. But the problem with that is that you have no sense when that result comes back how good the result is. In other words, how representative is it really of that yard? Were five enough? Should I maybe have had 10 or 20? By taking your set of increments and breaking them into at least four or five multi-increment samples, forming at least four or five multi-increment samples out of them, and sending those four or five off to the lab, I've incurred some additional lab expenses, but what I get back is data that give me a sense for the variability that's present in my results, which then can be used to give me a sense for how good my average is that I'm calculating. If I say my cleanup criteria is 400 ppm and I get a value back from the lab that's the average across my four samples is 300 ppm, how confident can I be that 300 ppm really represents a true average for the yard that's less than 400? When I have multiple sample results, I can start to use statistics to help answer that question. With just one sample result, I can't. All right. So this applies to XRF as well. I mean, you could conceivably pull a lot of different increments into one bag that sample, and then do XRF analyses through that bag sample wall, and then you'd have one bag sample average result. But you would have no idea how good that result was relative to the true average across the whole yard. If, on the other hand, I took those various increments and put them into four or five bags and then analyzed each of those four or five bags separately with an XRF, I could then start to draw conclusions about how good my average was. Excuse me. Any questions about that, or are people staying with me?
Bob, this is Jean. I had a few questions that were submitted online during the course of these slides, and I figured now would be a good time to just step back and take a look at those questions. The first one that came in online, they're asking about the arsenic and lead rules. This is coming in from Alabama, and he asks, what was the 10 times rule mentioned with lead and arsenic interference determination?
The rule is that if your lead concentration is more than 10 times your arsenic concentration, be suspicious of your arsenic result from the XRF. That's the basic rule. Because if lead is more than 10 times your arsenic concentration, it might be exerting an undue influence on your XRF's ability to estimate arsenic. And typically what will happen if that effect is happening is it'll pull your arsenic value up. So in other words, it may be saying that you have, let's just say as an example, you have 400 ppm present of lead, and your XRF is reporting 20 ppm. I'd be suspicious of that 20 ppm. It might be high. The true arsenic concentration might be 15, it might be 12, it might be 10. Really elevated levels of lead will tend to pull an XRF's arsenic estimate up.
Okay, great. And then the next question comes in from Massachusetts, and they ask, should we be looking at relative standard deviation rather than standard deviation to evaluate in-sample heterogeneity?
That's a really good question. My own feeling about that is relative standard deviation has a role to play and can provide some useful information. But the thing that you really want to focus on initially is the absolute standard deviation, because that true standard deviation, you can then start to do some things with it. For example, put confidence intervals around the concentration that's present within, a bag sample. That would give you some sense for how good your average reported bag value is, which is more difficult to do with relative standard deviations.
Okay, and there's another comment that just came in from Virginia, and I think this is in reference to your 10 times rule, but feel free to provide more clarification. It says that it's mentioned about an EPA publication on sample preparation. Please repeat the reference number.
Okay. It's on that slide, and I guess I could quick flip back and see which slide that was. Hold on just a second.
Slide
19? 15.
Yes.
It's in slide 15, so... I think people have the ability to backtrack with their slides, don't they, Jean?
Yes, they do. Yep, they can go back to slide 15.
If you go back to slide 15, you'll see the reference there. And just in case you're not sitting in front of a computer, you're just listening to the phone, it is EPA/600/R-03/027.
Okay, great. I don't see any more questions that have come in online. Just a reminder, if you do have a question, feel free to use that question mark icon to submit your questions at any point or comments online, and we will get to them at the next break. And Bob's been doing a really great job of announcing the number twice, and they're taking a break to ask for questions. If you are on the phone lines and he does ask, feel free to unmute your phone lines by pressing #6 and vocalize and ask your questions when he's ready. And just a last gentle reminder, we did have a little bit of interference. If you haven't done so, please mute your phone lines by pressing #6 right now. Thanks, Bob. Go ahead.
Okay. So slide 25. I'm going to introduce one additional basic XRF concept here that we didn't cover in the first module. But it's an important one. And it's important for the rest of this discussion. And what I want you to remember is something we did cover in that initial module, and that is your measurement error, your relative measurement error that the XRF produces, and the detection limits associated with your XRF reading both decrease with increasing count time. So the longer you take your measurement, the lower your relative measurement error is going to be on that result, for that result, and the lower the detection limit would be as well. Suppose that you've established a detection limit goal that you want to achieve, and you've done the work and determined that you need this amount of count time in order to achieve it. Let's just say that count time, for the sake of argument, or example, is 120 seconds. If I take my measurement for 120 seconds, that gives me the detection limit that I want to have for this particular metal that I'm really going after with an XRF. The point is, the basic concept is this third bullet. It doesn't matter whether you do that 120 seconds in one long shot or whether you do 120 seconds broken up over multiple shorter shots, for example, two 60-second shots, four 30-second shots, or eight 15-second shots. If you aggregate those shorter measurements, and when I say aggregate, I mean take the average of those shorter measurements, the detection limit that's going to be associated with that average is going to be exactly the same as the detection limit that would have been associated with a 120-second reading. Okay? So why is this important? Well, one of the arguments for not cutting back on measurement time with XRF is that the detection limits rise for the individual measurements. And that if you back off to 30 seconds or to 15 seconds on a measurement, oh, by golly, now my detection limit is twice or four times higher than what it would have been for 120-second readings, and that's not acceptable. Well, my point is, is, for example, if you're doing measurements across the bag surface and you cut those measurement times back for each individual measurement, say to 15 seconds, and then you aggregate or average all those results across that bag to get an average result, the detection limit that's going to be associated with that average is going to be just as good as the detection limit would have been if you had taken just one long extended reading on one point of that bag. This is why it's important, or this is why it's so useful, to force your XRF unit to report values that are less than the detection limit. Because we want those results. We need those results in order to calculate meaningful averages when we're taking multiple shots, say, across the bag surface. So, you know, when you hear us talking about, say, taking 8 measurements on a bagged soil sample, we aren't talking about taking 8 120-second readings, because that would just be a killer to have to do that with every bag sample. We're typically talking about taking 8 30-second readings or taking 8 15-second readings. In other words, the cumulative time isn't that bad. And the value that we get out of it is we're going to get detection limits that are just as good as if we had done one long measurement. So this basic concept, is particularly important for when we're doing repeated in-situ measurements at a particular location or when we're doing repeated measurements for bag samples. All right? So the next time somebody tells you, hey, you can't cut back on your count time to 15 seconds when you're doing bag sample results because that's going to kill your detection limits, your response should be very simple, and that is, no, it won't. It won't. Not as long as I'm taking enough measurements around my bag and I'm taking the average of all those measurements, I'm still going to get good data. That's the reality of the situation. Any questions about that? Slide 26. So let's switch from multi-increment sampling here to talking specifically about a bagged sample or if you're doing in-situ measurements at a specific location. So how many XRF measurements should you do for a bag? That was a question somebody had asked at some point here. Well, we're going to assume again our ultimate goal is to get an accurate estimate of the average concentration within a bag or if we're doing in-situ readings at a particular location on a soil surface. And we're going to recognize that the majority of the cost of using an XRF when we're pulling samples is the sample prep. It's not the XRF measurements themselves. It's the cost of handling the sample, and a significant cost of handling the sample is the homogenization we might have to go through in order to get a thoroughly homogeneous sample before we were to pull a cup out. Right? So this whole idea of measuring through the bag sample's walls is a way of circumventing or avoiding having to spend the money on homogenizing the sample. Okay, so the point here being that instead of spending a lot of labor on trying to homogenize that sample, I'm simply going to put that sample in my bag. I'm going to do multiple shots on both sides of the bag, take the average, and by golly, that's going to give me a result much faster, much cheaper, but as good as if I had spent a lot of money on homogenizing that bag and then pulling out one cup and doing an analysis outside the bag in that cup with your XRF. So how do you estimate, though, how many measurements it takes, it's going to take on that bag in order to get good data? So what you'd do is you'd select a bag with a concentration that you think is around your action level. You would have already identified what you want your detection limit to be, and you would have already have estimated what your total measurement time would have to be to get that detection limit. And once you've done that, then you could also identify what your analytical error would have been at that action level. All right? And then you're going to take 10 shots around that bag, 5 on each side, and you're going to observe the variability that's present in that data that you generate. And then you're going to sit back, and with the information you've generated so far, you're going to select your measurement numbers in a way so that, the process you do is you take the variability that you observe, divide that by the square root of the measurement number, and you want to make your measurement number big enough so that when you do that division, what you get is a number that's less than your expected analytical error at the action level. Well, that's really confusing. I apologize for that. But I'm going to give you an example here, which will hopefully clarify. So let's skip over to slide 27, and let's be very specific. You've seen this graphic before, a couple slides previous. This is a graphic where I showed you a whole bunch of bag sample results, and I'm plotting their average for each bag against the standard deviation that was associated in the bag. So let's just assume for this particular site that our action level is 400 ppm. If we look down on our x-axis in the 400 ppm range, I've got a red oval highlighted there or identified, and that's picking up the sample points, you know, the bag points that fall within that oval are basically the bag samples that are giving us average results for the bags around 400 ppm. We know that around 400 ppm, our XRF measurement error is less than 5% for a 120-second reading. And that's good enough for us. Okay, that gets us the detection limits we want, and that gives us great analytical error. 5%, who can complain about that? So what we notice, though, is that when we have bag samples with concentrations around 400 ppm, and we do multiple measurements on those bags, the standard deviation associated with those multiple measurements is actually around 34 ppm, or 8%. So it's almost twice as much. The variability that's present there is almost twice as much as the variability that's associated with straight analytical error. So really what's driving us bananas for these bags is not our analytical error, it's the heterogeneity that's within the bag. How would we deal with that heterogeneity? Well, I want to get that 8% down to something less than 5%, so I want to at least cut it in half. If I'm going to cut it in half, that means that I have to take that, so cutting it in half, that's dividing by 2. If I square 2, I get 4. That means I have to have at least 4 shots per bag to reduce the overall error in my average estimate for the bag to less than 5%. And with 4 shots, to get the same detection limits that I wanted to get with a 120-second reading, 4 and 120, that means each of those shots should be 30 seconds. So for this particular site, 4 30-second readings would get my heterogeneity under control within that bag sample without having to do any homogenization of that sample at all, and would give me accurate data around 400 ppm for those samples. Now, this is obviously concentration dependent. If my concentration of concern was something higher, let's say our action level was 800 ppm, well, I go over to my x-axis and I look at 800 ppm, and then I look up at the points that sit above 800 ppm, and I see that my standard deviation there is hanging probably on average between 50 and 100 ppm, which is an error that's more on the order of 10% to 12% to 15%. Okay? So that relative error will grow. It's going to grow as our concentrations increase. And to pull that error down so that it's now around the error, in the range of our analytical error, it's going to take more shots per bag, right? So the higher your action level here, the more shots per bag you would want to be taking to make sure that you're getting results around your action level that are reliable. That's the takeaway point. So in this particular case, 400 ppm, common standard for lead, 4 shots per bag, 30-second shots, just fine. That would do the job for us, and we wouldn't have to do anything else from the perspective of homogenizing those bag samples. We could be content with that. It's an interesting, this whole issue of measuring through the bags is interesting because at first blush, most people's reaction is, well, you're going to get data that's not as good as if we had homogenized what's inside the bag and taken a cup sample out and then measured with an XRF cup. We just completed a piece of work a couple weeks ago, and the data is too new to have made it into this presentation, where we actually compared the results we got from doing through-the-bag sample measurements prior to sample homogenization with the results we got from cup XRF samples after the sample had been homogenized. And we got more reliable data from the bag samples measuring through the bag than what we got from the cups. We had a third way of looking at the concentrations present in those samples. And that third way agreed with the, provided much better agreement with the measurements that were taken through the bag walls than what it did with the result that we got from the cup sample, XRF measurements of that cup sample. Pointing to the fact, in this particular case, for this particular study, that the sample homogenization protocols we were using were not very effective at reducing the heterogeneity in those bags. And when we pulled our cup sample, we were still getting stung by sample heterogeneity, much more so than what we had thought we would. So not only can measuring through bagged walls give you better, cheaper data, it can actually give you better data as well as compared to doing cup analyses. That's kind of the takeaway point. Any questions? All right.
Bob?
Sure.
I had a question about the need to homogenize the samples in the bag. Doesn't that create any kind of interference? Because, I mean, if we get the we get the soil, my understanding is that we pass it through a number two sieve, and that way we have enough soil to homogenize and have a representative sample. If we just put the soil in the bag, is that the same if we took just multiple readings? Thank you.
That's a good question. Where we've done this in the past, I mean, obviously before you bag a sample, you're removing stones, you're removing organic material, twigs, grass, leaves, that kind of thing. Second thing that we typically do when we bag a sample is we'll crush the sample inside the bag. And so one of the protocols that we found, actually I didn't find it, it's a contractor who demonstrated to me and I was impressed, is they double bag the sample, putting the first bag into a much heavier bag, and then took a rubber mallet, and they whacked the heck out of the sample a couple times on each side to break up the aggregates that are there, because aggregates will potentially introduce matrix effects on your XRF result. But once they had the aggregates broken up and that would allow them to present to the XRF detector a flat surface on the bag where, you know, you had soil uniformly kind of distributed underneath that flat surface, so there was good contact and a relatively uniform particle size, we found that we actually got good data. In that particular case, again, better data than what we then obtained by thoroughly processing the sample and taking cup samples. It was surprising, but we felt like we were getting actually better information. So there may be a need to sieve your samples before you put it in the bag, and I'm not saying that isn't a wise thing to do or that you shouldn't do that. I'm just saying, what I am saying is that it is not necessarily to your advantage to spend a lot of time trying to homogenize that sample before you put it in the bag and start taking measurements, because it's not necessarily going to gain you anything.
Bob, the only other caution to that would be Dina's module with regards to knowing what your decision is and your decision support. In other words, if you need to sieve based on what your decision is and what your exposure scenario is, then you know the full particle size in the sample bag and doing that is a little more problematic.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. If you're really focused on the fines and you need to know what the fines contain, then obviously what I'm describing doesn't apply in that particular case. If your interest is in what the average concentration is in the bulk matrix, then what I'm talking about applies. Yeah, that's a good, thanks for bringing that up. That's a good caveat.
Bob, we had a few more questions that came in online.
Okay.
I'm going to address those now. The first one I think I can answer. This is coming in from Oakland, California. They want to know what is VSP, and then they also mentioned that they tried accessing information for 600R-03027, and they weren't able to get to that section. The first question for VSP, that stands for Visual Sampling Plan, it's a software application. We have included it in the link to additional resources. It's the very first resource you'll see. You can go right to the website and actually download it. So at the end of today's seminar, the last slide will point you to the links to additional resources, and you can find VSP there. As for accessing the reference that was brought up about sampling, it's also included in the additional resources page. You will find it about halfway through under the soil sampling information, and it's a document entitled Guidance for Obtaining Representative Laboratory and Local Subsamples from Particulate Laboratory Samples. So you can do a search on CLUIN for that document number, and you'll be able to find the reference the same way. Getting back to some of the questions that came in, we had a question that came in from Kansas City, Missouri. Can any instruments aggregate multiple shots in the instrument, or do you need to record and manually average?
Yeah, that's slide 28. We're going to talk about that. So I'll take that question.
Okay, and I think you just mentioned that he found that. And then the next slide comes in from Knoxville, Tennessee. This is in reference to slide 23. They ask, can you please revisit and expand on the last bullet about MIS? Are you basically saying that MIS isn't useful if the XRF is only used to generate data for a COC that is easily analyzed by the instrument, like lead or arsenic? Is that because you can repeat the XRF analysis for a lot of individual grab samples and gather all the data you need based on a high number of XRF samples to characterize the site?
And the answer is yes. That's because if your contaminant of concern or contaminants of concern are all directly addressable by an XRF, then there is no cost savings with doing MIS. As a matter of fact, you lose a little bit, because what you lose is you lose an understanding of the variability that's present increment to increment, which your XRF is going to give you. So for the little bit of additional cost of doing XRF analyses on each of those increments, you get a lot more information, and there's no point in doing MIS in that case.
Okay, that was the end of the online
questions,
so go ahead.
Okay. So let's talk about 28 here quickly, and this goes directly to a question somebody asked. And both, for both Intevax units and Nikon units, you can set them up so that they will automatically aggregate a sequence of measurements and then report back the average concentration based on that sequence of measurements. That simplifies the process of having to manually download data from multiple measurements and then take them into a spreadsheet and calculate the average. So the XRF is saving you some work there if you set it up to do that. The problem with that is that the way the XRF, and this is true for both manufacturers, the way the error and the detection limits are reported for that aggregate measurement is not correct. And it can get you into a little bit of a trouble. So, for example, for an aggregate measurement, based on that kind of process, the XRF has the potential for reporting it as a non-detect, when in fact it's not a non-detect, when in fact it is a detection, and it's usable data. So you have to be careful in using the aggregate settings on instruments. And as a matter of fact, given the ease with which it is to pull data off an XRF and load it into a spreadsheet and work with it, I think my recommendation at this point would be not to use an aggregate setting on an XRF, but just to record the shots individually and do your averaging and your math off in a spreadsheet. That would be the recommendation. All right, let's take a look at slide 29. I'm going to present now a sequence of slides that are going to repeat a little bit of something that you saw before, but it's important, and it also kind of leads into this whole idea of dynamic work strategies. And this is our first foray, really, into dynamic strategies with an XRF. So what I'm going to be presenting to you is applicable both to in-situ readings and to bagged sample readings, situations where we're taking the reading through the bagged sample wall. And in both cases, an XRF will quickly give us a sense for what the levels of contamination are present. So the question is, again, let's think of our bag sample for a moment. Do we really need to take the same number of measurements each time for every bag? Or is there a way of adjusting the number of measurements from bag to bag that reflect our initial reading? And the answer is yes, in fact, there is. As a matter of fact, depending on what you're trying to do with your XRF, you may well want to take fewer readings when you have a sample that's at background levels or at very high levels and focus your measurement investment on those bag samples where our results are really more in the range of our action level. And this whole kind of the dynamic strategy I'm going to present here, it's particularly effective when you're trying to look for the presence or absence of contamination above or below some action level within a sample or within a decision unit. So in other words, let's say you're doing in-situ shots in a decision unit and you're quickly, in somebody's yard, and you're quickly trying to find where the problem is. This kind of process, or what I'm going to describe to you, would have exact application there. So let's go to the next slide, slide number 30. Here's the example. This is a real example. This is actual data I'm going to show you here. We have, in this particular case, bag samples, and we're doing our measurements through a bag. And we would like to have some kind of decision rule that we're going to apply to each bag to figure out how many measurements we're going to take for each bag. Our action level here is 25 ppm. So we're interested in being able to quickly identify which bags are above 25 ppm versus which are below. So at the start, we've set aside three bags that we're pretty confident are in that range of 25 ppm, and we've measured each bag 10 times, 5 times on each side. It gives us a total of 30 measurements. When we look at the average concentrations for those three bags, we find that, in fact, one bag has 19 ppm, another has 22, and the third has 32 ppm. So, in fact, they are all ballpark of our 25 ppm action level. And again, we have now 30 individual measurements total to work with. The next slide, slide 31, shows the results of those 30 measurements in the histogram on the right. And on our x-axis, we have our ppm bins, and our y-axis indicates how many measurements fell into each one of those bins. So, for example, for the bin of 10 to 15 ppm, we had three of our 30 fell in that bin. 15 to 20, we actually had 8 measurements that fell into that bin. So this gives us a sense for the distribution of the results we saw from our various individual readings of those bags. Looking at this, without doing any complicated math or statistics or anything like that, a decision rule becomes kind of obvious. And that is, for these three banks where we have concentrations around our action level, when we took an individual reading, we never saw anything that was less than 10 ppm. Conversely, we never saw anything that was greater than 50 ppm. All of our data hung between 10 and 50 ppm. So this would suggest a decision rule going forward as we check our bags. And that is, if we take a first reading on a bag and it comes back less than 10 ppm, well, by golly, we'll stop. And we'll say, hey, this bag is clearly below our action level and we aren't going to bother with it anymore. On the other hand, if we take our first measurement on that bag and we see something that's above 50 ppm, we'd say, whoa, we've obviously got a problem here. This bag certainly has an average concentration that's above our 25 ppm action level. So set that bag aside. If we run into our first measurement that's ranging between 10 and 50, then we might stop and say, well, we've got some contamination here, but we're not sure whether what we've got is above or below our 25 ppm action level. Let's take a couple additional measurements to figure out exactly what we've got in this bag. So here you have an example, our first example of a dynamic work strategy using XRF. And depending on how this, applying this may mean if we're running into a lot of samples and they're all at background levels that we're only taking one shot per bag and we're ripping right through them. Or if we're into an area where there's heavy contamination, we may find, again, we're only taking one shot per bag because each of those shots is telling us these bags are problems and we're ripping right through them. And then we'll save our time and effort for those bags where, in fact, it's not so clear what's going on, and we need some additional measurements to get a better estimate of what is actually in the bag. So, an example of a dynamic work strategy in operation. Any questions? If not, then let's look at slide 32. And this is my last slide with respect to multi-increment sampling. I'm going to give you a warning. And the warning is this. When we do multi-increment sampling and are taking soil samples from multiple locations and combining them into one sample, that significantly increases the potential for within-sample heterogeneity, right? Because it's very possible that we might be grabbing one increment from background soils and another increment from a very hot area, and we put them in the same bag. Well, we've got a very heterogeneous, we've got a bag with a lot of variability in it. What that means is that multi-increment sampling has the possibility of exacerbating the effects of poor sample preparation on either XRF cup analyses or off-site laboratory analyses, for example, ICP. In other words, using a multi-increment sampling kind of approach, you end up creating samples that are typically have more variability in them than what an ordinary grab sample would have, which means that you're going to have to pay more attention to homogenizing that sample if, in fact, you're going to be relying on XRF cup analyses to figure out what's inside that sample, or if you're going to be sending that sample off for ICP analysis. This is a non-trivial problem, and it can really bite you if you're not careful. Any questions? All right. Then I'm going to move on to the last topic for this particular session, and that is talking about using things like the XRF for increasing the amount of information you have to make decisions that you need to make. I think in some of the previous modules, we have probably used the term collaborative data sets, and we may have used it without fully explaining what it was we're talking about. Well, I'm going to use the term collaborative data sets for the rest of this module, and when I refer to collaborative data sets, what I'm really referring to is situations where I have information coming from at least two different sources, i.e. from an XRF and from ICP. In those settings where I have information, analytical results coming from more than one source, from at least two different sources, I have the possibility for using that data collaboratively. And what I mean by collaboratively is trying to emphasize the strengths of both analytical techniques and using them in a way that focuses on their strengths and balances their weaknesses. Okay? So in the case of something like an XRF, which presumably is a lot cheaper, it's a lot faster, but maybe has not quite as good analytical quality as ICP, we'll use that for generating a lot of dense sampling, relatively dense sampling information. And that allows us to manage the kind of spatial heterogeneity that Dina spent two modules talking about earlier in this series. And we'll reserve our ICP analysis, our more costly, time-consuming, but more definitive lab work, to focus on QC, or to focus on those situations where perhaps the XRF data might be suspect. Perhaps we're outside our dynamic range. Or perhaps we have evidence that interference effects might be happening for these particular sets of samples, that kind of thing. So we'll try to play on the strengths of both techniques, and in the end we end up with two data sets that working together help us to manage all sources of our decision uncertainty, both those that arise from sampling work and those that arise from analytical uncertainty. All right, next slide, please, slide 34. So if you think about collaborative data sets, particularly with lab data in the XRF, what are the different scenarios for how these data sets might be combined? Well, the optimal scenario is we basically replace our lab data with our XRF. So the goal here is to almost virtually do away with our expensive traditional analytical technique and just consign it to the role of very limited QC and really rely on our real-time technique, our XRF, for doing all the heavy lifting when it comes to actually making decisions. The idea being that because the XRF is so much cheaper, well, golly, we either are going to be able to collect a lot more data for the budget that we have, or we're going to be able to reach our decision at a much lower cost than what we would have been able to otherwise. Okay? But there's a couple of assumptions here. First of all, and we've kind of touched on some of these before, so I'm just going to kind of summarize, assumes our XRF is unbiased over the range of data that we're potentially going to run into. It assumes that linear relationship that exists between our XRF data and our lab data has a very high correlation. And SW 846, method 6200, talks about correlation coefficients that exceed 0.9 as being one of the criteria. We still would reserve our lab technique for QC purposes, but then you could take those results and deploy, say, that XRF either in a static kind of work program, data collection program, or in a more dynamic kind of work program. So requirements for doing this, obviously, is you've got to convince yourself and your regulator that, in fact, your XRF is swappable for your ICP analysis when it comes to the data that it's going to be generating, which may or may not be a trivial task. An example of this, we just, again, completed a piece of work at a DOE site where the XRF was being compared to ICP, not ICP in that particular case, something called alpha spectroscopy for uranium. And based on the data that we saw, the cups that the XRF analyzed were actually sent off for alpha spec analyses. We got a correlation coefficient of 0.99 and a slope on our regression line of almost exactly 1. So that data lined up perfectly. And the case that we're going to be making in that particular situation is that data is so good from the XRF that there is no reason to rely on alpha spectroscopy, which is very expensive, very time-consuming, and error-prone from a sample prep perspective. No reason to rely on alpha spec. We should be able to make our decisions based on XRF alone. By the way, in that particular case, the detection limits for the XRF were well below the action levels that we had to meet for the uranium contamination that we were chasing. So it's certainly possible. It's certainly plausible with an XRF that you might be able to generate pure contaminant of concern data that's good enough to be considered swappable for ICP. Let's go to the next slide, though, slide 35. But it's also the case that maybe people are a bit squeamish about completely relying on the XRF, that people still want to see a certain number of splits going off to the lab, and then there's an interest in being able to use that data, being able to combine that data in some kind of quantitative way to estimate, say, an average population or an average for a decision unit or for a population that you're investigating. There's a way of doing this, and it's an algorithm that's contained in Visual Sampling Plan, again, VSP. It assumes that you have two methods, XRF and ICP. It assumes your XRF data are unbiased. It assumes that you can come up with a linear correlation, although it doesn't have to be a great linear correlation. You just have to have one. And then it provides a way of combining those data statistically to come up with a better estimate of the average concentration than what you would have gotten using either of the two sets of data alone. Now that's something you can use VSP to do. VSP has all the necessary statistical routines that you might need to do this. But that's a second option. If you're not quite sure you want to rely entirely on the XRF. There's some queasiness about using XRF alone. Slide 36. But there are still other settings where neither of those two approaches will work. That you think that the XRF data are providing some value, but you look at scatter plots and regression lines, you say, golly, it's just really not there completely. But we'd still like to use our XRF to help us make the decisions that we have to make. How do we go about doing that? Let's go to slide 37. And here's an example. The scatter plot you're looking at shows XRF data for uranium on the x-axis plotted against the contaminative concern at this site, which was not uranium, it was thorium-230. And in this particular case, it just so happened that thorium-230 and uranium were co-located. Thorium-230 was the risk driver, but there's no good way of chasing thorium-230 in the field with any kind of real-time analytical technique. It was co-located, though, with uranium, and I can get uranium with an XRF. I can get it very well. The question here is well, okay, can I use my XRF to help that guide decision-making about where I have thorium problems versus where I don't, based on that XRF uranium data? Well, when I do a scatter plot of my uranium results against my thorium-230 results, it's awful. And you can see the scatter plot here for yourself. I can try to put a regression line through it, but I get an R-squared of only 0.33. And if I were to present that to a regulator, I'm sure I'd get laughed out of the meeting. Right? So this data does not look good at all. The question is there anything that's salvageable here that would still allow me to use the XRF to be making some real-time decisions? So what I'm going to be presenting you here with in the next couple of slides, the last final set of slides, is a methodology for using an XRF in more of a qualitative kind of way. It'll still support decisions that need to be made, but in situations where perhaps your regression lines aren't as good as what you might like them to be. And you've seen some of this before, so I'm going to be covering some ground that both Dina and Steve have touched on, but I'm going to be going into just a little bit more detail than either of them have. So hopefully this isn't all new. So the idea here is, well, can we use an XRF when really our decision focus is yes or no? When we aren't really so much concerned about the exact concentration that's there for our contaminant concern, but what we're really concerned about is it there at levels where we might have to do something? Is it above our action level, for example? So the question is contamination present at levels of concern? Or an alternative might be, should I be sending this sample off for more definitive analysis based on what I'm seeing off my XRF? And to answer this question, we're going to propose a non-parametric analytical approach to looking at the data. And it's going to rely on two different investigation levels, something we'll call a lower investigation level, an LIL, and something we'll call an upper investigation level, a UIL. Now there on the bottom, you'll see a graphic where basically we have our real-time analytical result running along from low to high. And those two investigation levels, our LIL and our UIL, divide our real-time results into three distinct zones. When we're above our upper investigation level, we're confident that we have contamination problems. When we're below our lower investigation level, we're confident that we don't have contamination problems above action levels. And when we get our real-time results, i.e. EG XRF results, in between those two, well, maybe then we're candidates for sending these samples off to the lab. So let's look at slide number 39. So how do you pick that lower investigation level and that upper investigation level if you're trying to do this with an XRF at a particular site? Well, what we're really worried about are making decision errors, right? And there really are two different kinds. There's a false clean error, and that is, okay, we've got our XRF data, and we conclude that we're below our action level, but turns out we were wrong. Well, that's an error that we want to try to avoid. So we want to try to minimize that error. But then there's a second error as well. And the second error is, well, I've got my XRF data, and I'm looking at it for this particular sample, and I've decided that, hey, it's contaminated. But the fact is if I had bothered to send the sample off to the lab, I might discover that, in fact, no, that the results were below my action level. Well, that's a false contaminated error. And we want to try to minimize that one, too, right? So in the best world, both those error rates, the false clean and the false contaminated, would be low. Now, the reality is for any particular application, the lower you drop your lower investigation level, the lower your false clean rate, error rate is going to be, right? Same thing with the upper investigation level. The higher that the upper investigation level is, the lower your false contaminated error rate is going to be. All right, so keep that in mind. The second thing here that drives this, though, is cost. The bigger the distance between our lower investigation level and our upper investigation level, the greater the fraction of samples that may require off-site confirmatory analysis. So the assumption here is, if we get an XRF result and it falls between that lower level and that upper level, we're going to send that sample off to the lab to find out exactly what's going on. Well, the more samples that I have to send off, the less of an incentive there is to use the XRF, right? So the worst case scenario here is I might be sending all my samples off to the lab, so why bother with the XRF at all? So in the best scenario, you know, I would be sending very few off to the lab for confirmatory analysis. That lower investigation level and that upper investigation level would do a good job of partitioning my samples either into known problems or known not problems. So this equation that's given here basically gives you a quick way of evaluating whether it's cost effective to use something like an XRF in this kind of scenario. And I won't go through the details of the equation, it's pretty straightforward. But as long as the ratio of your real-time cost, your XRF cost per measurement, is less than a certain fraction of the fixed lab ICP costs, as long as that's less than the number shown on the right, it makes sense for you to do this. If it's not less than it, it doesn't make sense to do this. So you have a quick way of checking to see whether this makes economic sense for your particular site or not. So let's go to the last three slides here. Let me try to illustrate it. So what you're looking at here is a scatter plot. In this scatter plot, along my x-axis, I have my real-time result, XRF, EG. Along my y-axis, I have my lab result, for example, ICP. In this particular scatter plot, I have 10 samples that have both XRF and ICP results, all right, to work with. Now, my action level for this particular example is 40 ppm, and so you see the orange line cutting across horizontally through the 40 ppm number on the lab result y-axis. That orange line divides my graph into two sections, upper and lower. Right? I also have a green line here that corresponds to just one investigation level. And that investigation level is pointing to around 24 ppm. Now, if I take that investigation level line and my action level line, you'll notice that they divide my graph into four different regions. Region 1, region 2, region 3, region 4, and they're identified by Roman numerals. And then my points fall into one of those four regions. Points that fall into region 3 are places where the XRF agrees with the lab. In other words, both are calling those samples clean. Points that fall into region 2 are places where, again, my XRF is agreeing with my lab. Both are calling them contaminated. Points that fall in region 1 are points where an XRF, based on that investigation level, would call that sample clean, but in fact the lab would identify it as dirty. That's a problem. That's a false claim. Points that fall into region 4 represent points where my XRF is identifying problems, but in fact the lab indicates that they're not, and that's a false contaminated issue. The way this line is drawn, this green line is drawn right now with an investigation level set around 24 ppm, I have 0 points that fall into that region 1, so my false clean rate is 0%, but I have a whole bunch of points that fall into that region 4. And in fact, using this investigation level with these data, I'm seeing a false contaminated rate of 50%. It's 50% of the time I'm calling things contaminated when I shouldn't be. That's not good. Okay? So, well, how to solve that? Well, go to the next slide, slide 42. I could solve it by pushing my investigation level from 24 ppm up to 45 ppm. And by golly, by doing that, I have eliminated all the points that fall in region 4. My false contaminated rate there drops to 0%. But my false clean rate suddenly takes a jump up to 25%. That's not good. You know, my regulator's not going to be happy with that. If 25% of the time I'm calling things clean when in fact they're not, that's not good. And these two graphs hopefully underscores a point for you. When you have just one investigation level, you can either use that investigation level to address your false clean error rate, or you can use it to address your false contaminant error rate, but you can't use it to do both. Because decreasing one will increase the other. And that's the way it works with just one investigation level. To go to slide 43, if we have two investigation levels, though, a lower investigation level and an upper investigation level, it solves the problem for us. So the way this works, again, is if my XRF result is below my lower investigation level, which here is set to 24 ppm, I'm going to say it's clean. That sample's clean. If my XRF result is above my upper investigation level, which here is around 45 ppm, I'm going to say that sample's dirty. If my XRF result falls between those two, I'm going to say, off to the lab with those samples. I'm not sure what's going on. Using these two investigation levels, I can pick them so that my false clean rate, error rate, is 0%, and my false contaminated error rate is 0%. What's the price I pay? The price I pay is now I've got four ICP analyses I need to do on those four samples, which fall between those lines. In this particular case, that's 4 out of 10. So 40% of my samples here I would have sent off-site to a laboratory to have their analyses done. So as you can see, or as I hope you can see, if I take that LIL and UIL and squeeze them closer together, it'll reduce the number of samples I'm sending off to the lab, but the cost I'm going to pay for that is my false clean and false contaminated error rates are going to go up. If I spread those lower upper investigation levels farther apart, I can force those false clean and false contaminant error rates to zero, but the price I'm going to pay is I'm going to be sending more samples off to the lab. That's the balance. That's the balance that's taking place. So this kind of approach can be used anytime when you have XRF data that, for whatever reason, you don't feel is very quantitative, or there's questions about whether there's significant bias present, or whether there's significant interference effects going on, or whatever. Or if you're using your XRF as a proxy, in other words, the primary contaminant of concern is something you can't get with XRF, but there's something else there co-located with it, be it lead or who knows what, that the XRF can get, and I'm going to use the XRF going after what I can get to make decisions about what I can't get with a real-time technique. In those kinds of settings, this kind of approach can be very, very effective. And I do believe that's the last slide I have in this sequence, and that's it for the day. So if there are any questions about what I just went over, or questions about earlier material that we covered that you'd like to talk about, I'd be more than happy to do that with the time that we have left.
Bob, this is Jean. We had a few questions that came in online, and then we'll open it up to the phone participants. The first one that came in online comes from Massachusetts, and they asked, how do you manually calculate the detection limit and error? What formulas are used?
Detection limit and error. Okay, if you have, well, there's a couple ways of doing it. If you have samples, either calibration standards or spike samples or historical samples from the site, or maybe even an initial sample from the site with detectable concentrations from an XRF analysis, that measurement will give you, for that concentration, also the error that's associated with it. Once you have that one point nailed down, and assuming there aren't significant interference effects going on, you can then calculate the error over the expected error over a range of concentrations and for a variety of acquisition times, recognizing that in terms of acquisition time, error is a function of the square root of the acquisition time, and that a similar kind of relationship holds for concentrations, at least for relative error. And so just by having one known point and then making the assumption that that known point doesn't have any significant interference effects going on, you can extrapolate out what the detection limits would be for any particular acquisition time concentration combination that might run into with that particular XRF unit. It's a relatively straightforward calculation.
Okay, great. The next question comes in from Alabama, and they ask, were the bag samples in slide 30 MIS samples?
Let me go back to slide 30. No, these weren't. Actually, it's interesting. These samples were from soil cores. And the question, just to give you a little bit of background to this particular effort, we were looking for buried contamination here. And we were using the XRF to quickly screen soil core segments, 6-inch segments. And so the question was how to do it rapidly so that we'd be able to identify when we got into contamination that we knew it was buried someplace, we just didn't know where it was. So it was a methodology used for that. So no, these were not multi-increment samples. These, in fact, were discrete 6-inch cores off of geoprobe soil cores.
Okay. The next question comes in from Oakland, California, and they ask, what are common slopes of the regression analysis between XRS and lab results? High, and then in parentheses, adequate correlation, such as greater than 0.8, can be associated with a difference greater than, let's say, 30%, where you have a slope of 1.3.
That is such a loaded question. I'll tell you my experience, and that is we see slopes and R-squareds, adjusted R-squareds, that are all over the map with an XRF. But a common thing that we do see, so just some commonalities here. First of all, we get our best comparability when we send the cup off to the lab for analysis. A lot of times when we see poor comparability between XRF results and lab results, it's because a cup was pulled out of the sample, then the sample was sent to the lab, then the lab subsampled that sample and did an analysis on that subsample. And hopefully if we have convinced you of nothing else up to this point in time, we'll hopefully have convinced you that as your concentration, contaminant concentrations increase in your sample, the amount of variability within that sample increases as well. Which means there's a good chance that the lab is going to pull a subsample out of that original sample that's going to look different than the subsample you pull for your cup and analyze with your XRF cup. And so we'll get, and I've seen this with the uranium data, for sites that try to deploy an XRF and they come back and they'll show me a scatter plot and it'll look awful. And I'll ask them, well, what did you do how'd you do this? How'd you generate? And you come to find out, again, that they pulled a cup out of the sample and then they sent the sample off, the whole mass of the sample off to the lab, and who knows what the lab did, but you're guaranteed that what the lab analyzed was not the cup that the XRF originally analyzed. And so when there's a lot of disagreement, it's not analytical disagreement necessarily, maybe, but not necessarily, more likely, it's the fact that you're just staring spatial or within sample heterogeneity square in the face. That's what's causing your heartburn. Second thing I just want to mention with regard to that question is sometimes people, and we've hit on this, sometimes people focus on the R squared as the ultimate measure of the goodness of a regression. And the fact is it's only one measure. And in fact, by trimming away outliers, an outlier here in this particular case I would define for purposes of this discussion, maybe you have 20 points, 19 of which are run between 0 and 400 and one of ppm and one of which is at 4,000 ppm. That 4,000 ppm is going to drive your regression. And it's also going to give you R squared because I'll tell you what's going to happen. When you put a regression line through those points, it's going to nail the 4,000 ppm one and it's going to make it look like you've got a good line. You drop that 4,000 ppm point and you're going to see your R-squared drop, but you're going to end up with a better regression at the end of the day. SW846 talks about R-squareds that are greater than 0.9 as being good. And I think there's another value in there, too. Is it 0.7, Steve? Do you recall? 0.7 kind of sticks in my mind, that it should be at least 0.7. And if you get up to 0.9, that's wonderful. That's really kind of arbitrary, to be honest.
Yeah, my recollection is 0.7, the definition, and folks can go obviously read 6200, but the definition is if you have a R squared value better than 0.7, it's considered screening applicable for screening, whereas it could be potentially definitive with an R squared value greater than 0.9.
Yeah.
Okay, the next question comes in from Alabama, and they ask if you would explain slide 32 again.
Slide 32. Oh, okay, so, yeah, slide 32. Point here is that, again, I'm trying to emphasize the fact that whenever you're doing an ICP analysis or you're pulling a cup sample for XRF analysis out of a larger sample mass, say 400 grams, you have heterogeneity in concentration distribution within that original sample, which means if you were to pull multiple XRF cups out and analyze them, you'd see differences from cup to cup, not caused by analytical problems, caused by the variability in that sample. That variability increases as concentrations, average concentrations within a sample increases. That's an effect that we see time and time again. Every site I've ever been at, that's an effect that I've seen. Whenever you do multi-increment sampling, now you're in a situation where you're potentially pulling an increment from a background area, background soils, and combining it with an increment that represents very contaminated soils. And you're putting them in the same bag, and just the process of doing that guarantees that, you know, if you're to then pull a cup out without thoroughly homogenizing that bag, well, you have a 50-50 chance of either pulling out the background soil or pulling out the highly contaminated soil, okay? So you've just increased the amount of heterogeneity that's in that bag as compared to what you might have seen from just one straight graph sample. So to the extent that within bag heterogeneity is a problem, and it is a problem, it is truly a problem, and I hope you appreciate that, is that that problem is exacerbated by multi-increment sampling, which means simply that you have to pay more attention to your sample prep if you're going to use multi-increment sampling than what you would have otherwise, because the problems that exist are going to be amplified in terms of variability within the sample, within that overall sample that's been formed now from several different increments coming from different places in your area.
Well, to get around that, could you say there's two ways to get at it, whereas you could do additional sample prep on that sample or on that multi-increment sample, or could you also take additional measurements on that multi-increment?
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the things we're advocating here, or at least that I'm advocating, is that taking multiple measurements around a bag actually, again, based on my experience and a couple of different data sets that I've looked at, has produced better results, more representative, more reproducible results than spending a lot of time trying to homogenize the bag, pulling a sample out of that bag, and then trying to analyze that one sample. At least from an XRF perspective, that seems to be the case. So that would be one way of working around it, is just increasing the number of samples you're taking through the bag walls to get a better estimate of what's in that bag.
Could we generalize and say that if you wanted to use multi-incremental sampling to get at longer scale variability, that if you did it, you could use multiple shots within a bag to deal with within sample variability and have a much better job than doing either one alone or neither?
I think that's a perfect generalization. Yeah, that's the conclusion.
Okay. The next question comes in from Pennsylvania, and they ask, would the scatter plot for slides 41 through 43 be generated during a DMA? Because wouldn't you need an initial collaborative data set in order to make that graph?
Absolutely. This would be part of a DMA, and that DMA could either be a standalone piece of work before your main body of work gets going, or it could be the first two or three days, first couple days of your field effort if you're able to do quick turnaround with an off-site lab where you can quickly get back your initial set of results so that you can take a hard look at how your XRF in this particular case might be stacking up with your ICP. But DMA is certainly what you're talking here. Yeah.
The other thing, too, that stick on that thought, the other thing, too, about that concept is that for the most part, you probably are continuously refining that relationship by doing a percentage of samples where you are doing both the split and the XRF analysis, keeping in mind Bob's caution about, you know, sending off a 400-gram bag, which you took a 5-gram cup out of and ran the XRF analysis. But assuming that, put that aside, that continue some percentage, maybe 10 or 20% oftentimes as part of a QC program, that you can continue to make sure that those error rates hold with regards to the upper and lower investigation level.
I think that's an excellent point, Steve, and I'm glad you added that because I didn't touch on it. But you would certainly want to be watching these relationships as your work progresses to make sure that they do hold. And we do have had examples in the past where a relationship that we thought would hold across the site held for maybe 80% of the site and then fell apart for the other 20% for multiple reasons. So something you do want to watch.
And the last question that came in online, we're just a little bit past 3 o'clock, so we'll try to wrap things up in just a minute or two here. The last question comes in from Chicago, and they ask, when selecting LIL and UIL levels, wouldn't you need to consider where the upper and lower confidence limits or prediction limits on the regression line intercept the action level rather than looking at raw scatter plots?
Yeah, you could go down. The problem with going down the road of using confidence limits is you're starting to make some assumptions about underlying distributions. The beauty of doing what's being presented here, the way it's being presented, is there is no assumption at all about whether your data is normally distributed or well normally distributed or whatever. You're just taking the data for what it is and developing those investigation levels and really what boils down to a non-parametric kind of approach. So if you have, so I guess the short answer to that is if you had enough confidence in those confidence intervals that you're calculating, you might not even want to do this because you obviously have a better understanding of your data than typically we would have when we're setting up this kind of analysis.
Okay, looks like we got one more question that came through, and I think what we'll do is we'll hang tight. If there are any additional questions, we'll address them at the start of the next event in this seminar series, which will happen next Monday. There's a final question that came in asking about downloading the presentation slides via format. Anyone can access them from the seminar homepage, which is the same URL you were given in your email. There'll be links to download the presentation. You can also click on the orange button above the slides in today's seminar. It looks like a computer floppy disk or diskette. If you were to click on that, a little window will open up allowing you to download the slides. If there are no last-minute questions that people want to ask verbally on the phone lines.
And the last thing, keep in mind that we have the final session on the 28th of August, which is next Thursday. And so, for instance, if that last question, if we're still having issues with that or people want to talk about some of these concepts in more detail, that we have set aside time on next Thursday to do that. So we would encourage you to contact us or send in additional questions so that we can try to put together some material and talk about those things next Thursday.
Great. Thanks for that reminder, Steve. If I could direct everyone to the last slide, slide number 46, you'll find links to the additional resources. So many of the documents, the EPA 600 document on sampling that was mentioned earlier is on that page, as well as links to download VSP, DMA examples, and a number of other resources are all listed on that site. The second link on slide 46 is our feedback form, and we would greatly appreciate it if you could take just a moment or two to fill out a brief comment form so we know how we did today and look for your comments on future deliveries. As we've mentioned, if you have any follow-up questions, anything that we didn't address today, you can feel free to either submit them electronically right now or email one of the presenters or me. All of our contact information is listed on the seminar homepage, and we will address the leftover questions at the start of the next seminar, which is the seventh seminar in this 8-part series, and will be scheduled for next Monday to start at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So I thank Bob for your time, Steve for yours as well, and everyone who's able to join us. I hope you found it informative, and we'll all hear from you next week on Monday. Thank you.